Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Morning, everybody. Happy hump day and welcome to the News Agenda with me, Fleet Street Fox. And today I'm joined by my fellow Mirror columnist, Darren Lewis. Morning, Darren.
Morning, morning. You got a cup of coffee too. Much well-deserved and needed for us both.
Exactly. It's one of those mornings. Now, this is the People's Paper Review, so get into the comments, ask us your questions. We'll do our best to answer them for you. Those of you listening later on podcast will just have to resign from a dead-end job and hope someone else will think you're employable. So what have we got for you today? Well, the Mirror has splashed on two British men who have gone to join Vladimir Putin's illegal war on Ukraine, apparently the first known to have done so, and who face being jailed as terrorists if they survive and return home. More on that later, but first, talking about dead-end jobs and being unemployable, I want to go to page six, where two more Tory ministers have quit ahead of an upcoming election. Darren, is it the case that before long, do you think, Rishi Sunak is going to walk into his Downing Street office one morning and find a note on the desk saying, "I'm sorry, but there's no ministers left"?
You rehearsed that, didn't you?
It's very good. Thought about that one, yeah.
This is Lizzie Buchan's story about another two Tory ministers confirming they're going to stand down before the next election. That's now more than 60 MPs. Actually, I think it is 60 MPs, Tory MPs, who have told Rishi Sunak that they won't be standing down. All the indications appearing to be that, as things stand, their party is facing a wipeout. And I think, you know, the interesting thing, Susie, is that we've covered most of the reasons why. Well, you certainly have on this show. And I was trying to go through them in my head as you were talking. Living, cost of living crisis, the corruption, self-interest, xenophobia, lack of investment in the education system, the healthcare system, the police force. And all that is even before you even get to all the scandals, Windrush, Grenfell, blood cancer, party get, as you were saying. Matt Hancock had his trousers down during a period where he needed to put his head down, dealing obviously with all of that. So there's so much that the public just want to wave goodbye to. And that's why so many of the MPs understand or have decided that they want to go. The two guys in question in Lizzie's piece, I haven't even mentioned them yet. They're the Skills Minister, Robert Halfen, and the Armed Forces Minister, James Heapy. They're going to go immediately. That was the thing that struck me. Halfen, he's the Minister for MP for Harlow in Essex, which isn't that far away from me, and he's been an MP since 2010, I think. Mm-hmm. Rishi Sunak's, I think he's had the reshuffle already, but I think he's looking ahead to the local elections in May. The analysts who know what they're talking about suggest that the Conservative Party could lose half the seats that they're defending, which is a really big reason for why a lot of
the analysts reckon the Tories can keep half their seats. Good luck with that one, Rishi. I don't think that's quite right. Mike says, has Rishi Sunak appointed Jonathan Gullis as deputy chair of the Tory party to prevent him defecting to reform in May? And if so, will it work? Jonathan Gullis, for those of you who don't know, is the thickest lump of ham in the Conservative Party. And that's going some. And he's just been made deputy chairman. Now, there are umpteen deputy chairmen of the Conservative Party, and they all seem to get the role, really, to keep them quiet or to do, you know, deputy chairman in charge of paperclips, something like that. And Jonathan Gullis has been given this job in sort of the mini reshuffle that Sunak's been forced to have. And as our colleague Jason Beattie said in his politics newsletter, which I hope everyone subscribes to this morning, there is no clearer sign that you are scraping the bottom of the barrel than promoting Jonathan Gullis to an important job like that. And what do you think, everybody? Do you think these ministers going is a, you know, an inevitable sort of sign of impending doom? Or is it just one of those things and we should stop getting excited about it? If you're a minister, you are expected to campaign in a general election, which we're going to get at some point this year. In fact, you're quite an important part of that campaigning. So, and you have to go all over the country. So if your heart's not really in it, you know, it's quite right to bow out before the vote is called, so someone more enthusiastic than you can do the hard work, right? That makes sense. But Robert Harfon, who you said there's a skills minister, he spent 9 years trying to get elected in the first place, Darren. He stood twice before he finally got in 2010 under David Cameron. He lost twice there. Heapy's leaving tweets from the MOD make it really clear that he loves his job as Armed Forces Minister and considers that everything there was absolutely spiffing and marvellous. What can it be that has so sapped the enthusiasm of two such highly motivated men as Harfon and Heapy? They're not, you know, they're not mired in scandal. They're not facing a recall petition. They're not disgraced like Matt Hancock. They're not facing a by-election or anything else. They're highly motivated. They love the party. They love the job. And they've gone, do you know what? Yeah. It's about, like, me leaving the mirror, right? It would be the last rats on the ship, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Died in the wall mirror man, and you know, died in the wall mirror woman. So I think, yeah, we would be the last two rats on the ship. But I think as far as these two are concerned, I think you're right. They're not rats. They're not mired in scandal. But I think they are an example of the many MPs on the Conservative Party, within the Conservative Party, within the Cabinet, who are looking at the list that I just read out to you a second ago and more, and that we may not even know about at the moment. And they're deciding there have been so many areas of our society that have simply been burned to the ground that they've simply given up trying to win over the voters. It's going to be such a tough, arduous job. And they've decided, look, it's better for them to quit than to bow out, than to be thrown out, rather. And the interesting thing is, I was reading a piece about, I can't remember the minister's name, George Osborne, it might have been. They called him Nine Jobs, George Osborne.
Yeah.
I think it was. And I think in some cases, you know, MPs, the more celebrated, and I use that word advisedly, higher profile, I should say, ones probably will go into well-paying jobs in business, in various corporations, but not everyone will. And I think many of them will want to give themselves the opportunity to be able to find jobs that they think they can go into, rather than trying to flog a dead horse by trying to convince voters to disbelieve the evidence of their own eyes. And that's the reason I think they'd go. I've been looking at some numbers. I've got them on my screen here. And that really did fascinate me, Susan. I'm just going to read you a couple of them at the moment, because in 2010, 150 MPs stood down. So although it looks horrendous for the Tories, there is a precedent for a lot of MPs standing down in the past. And the 150 MPs that stood down in the past, they were mainly from the Labour Party, and they saw the end coming and they decided, you know what, we're going to jump ship. Now, an average of 87 MPs stood down in elections between 79 and 2010. But, and I read those numbers to say the big difference is, and you will know this even better than me, this year, the many of the MPs who are off are young, in some cases really young, some in their 30s, a couple in their 40s. I think Mary Black is standing down as well, and she's quite young too. And
yeah, she's that a baby is, of house, isn't she? She's only in her 20s.
Exactly, and this is quite a significant area to kind of think about in terms of MPs deciding, you know what, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah, they don't seem to want to have, you know, although if you think about some of the grand old war horses we've got on the back benches, Harriet Harman in Labour, for example, the mother of the house, you've got Tory grandees on their back benches, have been there for a million years in opposition and in government. And the people that are sort of leaving now don't really want to have spend any period in opposition, it would seem. And, you know, they stake their jobs and their careers on popularity and winning, and they seem so certain to lose next time, they just don't want to be the one who's the loser, if you like. Mike says maybe they're abandoning their ministerial roles to give them a head start in an outside job to avoid ACOBA, which is the organisation which vets future jobs for former ministers. It's absolutely toothless. It makes no difference whatsoever. It's done nothing to stop Boris Johnson, for example, cashing in with foreign magnates and goodness knows what else. But I've got to say, Darren, if they think they're going to leave the job in House of Commons and walk into something, you know, nicely well paid, unfortunately, the Conservative government, repeated Conservative governments, have left us with a low-wage economy. They could well find themselves on a zero-hours contract somewhere. What a shame that would be. And it is a pity about Robert Hawthorn. I'm right in saying he's the only physically disabled MP in the House of Commons, certainly the only one in government. And speaking as someone who has a non-visible disability, I have epilepsy, which was marked yesterday, Purple Day. It mattered that there's someone in the House who has to struggle with something physical and you know, is there as a symbol, if you like. So it matters that he's stepping down. But, you know, these guys, they're not just leaving office. Like many of the 60 that you mentioned, Darren, they're leaving politics all together. They're not just saying, I'm not going to be a minister, this isn't going to work. They're out. Now, obviously, as you said, there's going to be a bit of a glut in the non-executive directorship market, and there's going to be a lot of Tories fighting for those spots on the board. But why is it, Darren? Do you think, as I do, that, you know, they can see what will happen to their party after the election, the gutting, the infighting, the obvious switch to the right, which is coming, and they've just decided they want no part of it?
I think it is. I think right now politics, I think politics stopped a long time ago being about principle and became just a melting pot of culture wars, misdirection, xenophobia lurching to the right. And listen, we tend to characterize everyone within the Tory party and as being the same, but there are people whose politics are different to ours who are still honorable, principled people. And I said, certainly don't want to use this slot to bash all of them over their head, but those on the far right who are trying to push an agenda that characterizes everyone that is different as being a threat, it could well be that these MPs have decided, I don't want to be associated with these guys. I don't want to be in government with them. I don't want to be in government with them, but I don't want to be in opposition with them. This is an opportunity to jump ship. Because as you say, these aren't a couple of the more mendacious ones that are whose misdeeds are well documented. These are good guys. And you made the really pertinent point about representation. I'm a black guy. I want to see people who are different, who represent people who look like me in Parliament. We need for the contingent across this country who either have a visible disability or a non-visible disability to have somebody in Westminster who can empathise and sympathise and fight for them. And that's what we don't have. So these are dark moments. And the easy thing, of course, is to point and laugh and to, you know, have an element of Schadenfreude, but actually the lack of representation in the House of people whose views are not extreme, for people whose views might be slightly different, but do still deserve that representation in Westminster, it's concerning for all of us.
Yeah. What do you think, everybody? Do you think politics is lacking principle? Is it going to come back, do you think, after another election? And we had a very similar kind of, not an exodus, but an expulsion of what, for want of a better word, some of the sort of the traditional Tories, the One Nation Tories after Brexit, those who weren't loyal to Boris Johnson, who said, well, I think some of the things you're doing are incorrect and I will stand up for a principle, whether we agree with it or not, who stood up for a principle and didn't follow the government line because they thought it was the wrong line, got booted. They had the whip withdrawn and they stood down in 2019, some of them. So, you know, Ken Clark, Nicholas Soames have gone. I was speaking to a Tory backbencher the other day. I do it. I am friends with some of them. And who has been, I won't say his name, but he's been an MP for more than 20 years in opposition and in power. I don't think he's ever served in government, but he's seen it all and done it all. He's a very determined constituency MP who wants to represent people that who would vote him in and for their best interests. And he's just had enough. He's just had enough after the last few years of constant rowing and arguing and polarization. He's just got, do you know what? I could be fishing, and that's it. And he's an MP, so he's got a very nice pension. He can just go off and fish. But you know, if people who are dedicated and determined and principled are leaving politics, then that is a big issue, I would think. And it would be a great shame if that doesn't turn around the other way.
Yeah, because you go into politics initially, particularly if you're young, with an altruistic sense of virtue. You want to fight for people. You want to fight on issues of principle, or on issues for the people around you, for the people that you want to be able to pursue the things that drive you. And if you get into government, if you become a minister and you think, all right, here I am with a real opportunity to change things, and you put forward issues of principle, and you get told by your party leader or by, you know, whips or whatever, no, we're not going to talk about that. We're going to, I don't know, talk about the last night of the proms and why we don't have them anymore, or some kind of ludicrous piece drummed up by a section of the right-wing media that will deflect from the tough decisions that have got to be taken, or from the issues of principle that have to be discussed. Eventually, it must grind you down. It must make you think, what am I doing this for? And maybe there is another area of society that I could go into and really make a difference, rather than being part of this cabal, this cavalcade of clowns who really are just driving the country into the ground.
Yeah, a bit like journalism, really. You come into it for the best possible reasons. You get all your principles knocked out of you over the years. And eventually someone goes, oh, do you know what? Psh, PR, that's it, I'm done. But that does mean, of course, that there's none of the old sort of the old war dogs, if you like, who are red in tooth and claw, who are there to help, you know, the transition to the next stage. And without the principal people in the Conservative Party, the next opposition, if they form that one, will be slightly different, and it won't be better if it was a bit more reasonable. Anyway, we're running out of time. We do need to move on to the next story of the day.
Susie, you you make such a good point there, and it's just worth sticking with it, because I think we do need a strong opposition, because, you know, yes, we can't see the back of the Tories fast enough, but it doesn't mean that whoever replaces them should be able to enjoy power unchecked. And if you have a principled opposition, then there is a better chance of policy that might not necessarily be policy that we agree with being challenged, as it should be in a democracy. And exactly. If we don't have a strong opposition, what then?
Yeah, someone checks their homework. That's the point. And if you have a strong opposition, you know you need to do your own homework more carefully. Whereas if you have a weak opposition, you go, oh, this is fine, we'll just get it through. No one's going to stop us. We've got a majority of 174. Bang, we'll be all right. Anyway, we've been going for 17 minutes. We still haven't got to the main story of the day. I've planned it on these in the wrong order this morning because Darren's been able to go on about Tories much longer than he probably will this bit. Anyway, on to the main story of the day. The Mirror has revealed these identities of two British men who've gone to Donbass, not the Donbass, that's what Russians say, Donbass, in eastern Ukraine to fight in Vladimir Putin's mincing machine. So who are they, Darren? What can you tell us about them? We've got Ben Skimpson and Aidan Minnis.
Yeah, I'm glad you've known, because I'm thinking, do I really want to give these guys 5 minutes of fame? They don't seem like particularly pleasant pieces of work, but let's give credit to the guy who's put this all together. It's Matt Roper. It's his exclusive. It's on the British fighters who are flying to Ukraine. Very helpful caption there. To fight for Russia. They're thought to be the first Brits known to be fighting for Russia. Matt's had a really fascinating chat with them. And it says that they're in the Donbass region, as you were saying. And the piece actually quotes a former British Army Commander, Colonel Richard Kemp, who describes them both as a disgrace. I'd put that quite mildly, but there you go. And as you were rightly saying a bit earlier on, one of them's a convicted terrorist, the other one's an ex-National Front supporter and a drug addict. So when you're thinking to yourself, oh my goodness, what could have made these guys decide they're going to go out there? Well, I think that gives us a little nudge in the right direction. The one who has been jailed for terror offences. He spent 4 months helping a Russian-backed separatist group in 2015, which was the year after Russia annexed Crimea. And the background to that is that he'd gone over there to drive ambulances, and then he read Russian propaganda online, and the rest is horrifying history. So that's just a little bit about the guys that we're talking about.
Gosh, now what do you think, everybody? Do you think this is acceptable? Do you see that these guys as terrorists, or do you think that they're perhaps just a bit mistaken and they need to be sort of forgiven and all's well? Now, these, what have they done while they're there? Well, they've been posting on Instagram because they're geniuses, which is how they were spotted. Ben Stimpson, who Dan was just talking about there, said he went to Ukraine in 2015 to drive ambulances, but actually ended up fighting for Russians. When he returned home, he was jailed for 5 years for terrorism offences, because fighting with Putin is fighting with someone who uses terror. And you're also fighting against one of our allies. So that's a criminal offence. And when as soon as he was released, he seems to have gone straight back and done it again. Aidan Minnis is a former National Front member, a convicted thug whose lawyers once told a UK court in mitigation for some of his crimes that he was a Class A drug addict and alcoholic by the age of 20. Now, Darren, Putin isn't using these two for propaganda purposes. They're not being paraded. There he is, by Dobby the house elf. He's not shouting about it. He's not going, hooray, I've got British soldiers in my forces. Why might he not be really making a meal out of it?
Well, I think, as we've both been saying, these two individuals are not exactly paragons of virtue. And so it would not necessarily be the biggest flex, as the kids would say, to have these two miscreants as being symbolic of what you are trying to do. And, you know, as individuals, and there's a really good sidebar down the side of this piece by Matt Roper, by Chris Hughes, who's our defence and security editor. And he's talking about the fact that a lot of people out there have been press ganged into it. A lot of the men that have gone to war, they've not gone through choice. They've gone because they've had to. But in this case, and, you know, some people do it for money, some people do it for freedom. They've got all their reasons out there. That some individuals out there do that. Forgive me, just turn this little phone off. But this is very different, because they've chosen to go out there. They've chosen to sign up with a pro-Russia military unit. They've chosen to align themselves with murderers and torturers and people whose misdeeds are well documented. If you've been anywhere near a TV or a newspaper over the past however long, you will know that they are well documented. But Putin doesn't want, you know, we haven't seen these two, as you've been saying, stuck in front of a camera, basically saying, you know, isn't Putin fantastic, and being used as propaganda precisely because of the kind of individuals they are. And one element, very quickly, of Matt's investigation, which was fascinating for me anyway, which he spoke to the families, and it talks about the impact that this whole thing has on the people around you who might, you know, who don't necessarily share your views, who are horrified by the decision that you've made. And Matt's talked to the father of one of these individuals, who just said, I cut him off. I don't want anything to do with him. And then Matt has also spoken to the individual about his father, and you get the picture, the bigger picture, that this is a very, very unhappy family. And the decision that the individual has made is as a result of a very, very, very troubled family life.
Yeah, very troubled men, both of them, it would seem. Now, Linda says, what about the Brits fighting for the Israeli military? The same questions apply. They don't actually, Linda, because Israel is our ally. And the criminal offence, whether you like it or not, is fighting against one of our allies. So if you were in Hamas, you would be committing a terror offence. If you were in the Israeli Defence Force, you are not committing a terror offence, according to British law. Added to which, the Israeli government is democratically elected. And the last time Hamas actually allowed anyone to have any elections in Palestine, which I think was more than a decade ago, they threw their political opponents off roofs. It's not quite the same, and the same questions do not apply, I'm afraid. And if you think I'm saying that because I'm paid by Israel, do let me know where I should send the invoice. I think they owe me some money. Now, these two in Russia, Ukraine, they're kind of the male equivalent of Shamima Begum. Okay, the young girl who's been had her citizenship stripped from her after she went off and joined ISIS. Now, they've left the country they were born in to fight in a foreign war on the wrong side. If they ever try to return to Britain, they would find themselves jailed again or stripped of their citizenship. Now, the last one probably won't happen, Darren, because these two aren't brown. And that tends to happen only to people who are brown, as far as we know. But these Instagram posts that they've made are going to be the primary evidence for whatever does happen to them after the war is over. They're not exactly strategic geniuses. Colonel Kemp, as he says there, has called them traitors to their country because we're helping Ukraine in the fight. They're literally fighting against our weapons and troops trained by us. And perhaps if one day things get worse, they might actually be fighting their countrymen directly. But it does seem, Darren, that a bit like Shamimi, you know, they've been brainwashed. They've been groomed to some extent. They had no hope lives and have just latched onto a cause that sort of somehow reaffirms all the worst things they've ever heard. And they're, you know, they've got a mindset that just isn't quite right. Do you have any sympathy for them now that they're in this sort of brutal war started by a dictator whose soldiers are dying every day and whose generals clearly don't give a damn about them?
Yeah, I mean, the second part of your question almost provides the answer, because on the one hand, you don't have sympathy for somebody who has decided, because their lives are empty, they're going to go and take the lives of other people. You do, however, and I'll phrase it, I'll be careful with the phrasing, but you do get an insight from Matt's piece of how it came to be. And you get the sense that perhaps as individuals, they never had a chance because of their upbringings. And that has really affected their decision-making. And it is a reminder that online propaganda, the impact can be devastating. And we're not just talking about children, but people whose lives are empty. They can be hoodwinked by that kind of thing into going and making decisions that won't just affect their lives, but affect the lives of so many other people. It's a terrifying story all round. And do I have sympathy for them? It's such a hard one. It's such a hard one. You drew the parallel with Shamima Begum. She was a child when she was groomed into making that decision. These are adults who consumed propaganda and were hoodwinked by it. The whole thing is a sorry situation all round.
Yeah, I mean, what Shamima called an ISIS bride, which she absolutely wasn't. She didn't get a choice about who to marry or anything else. She was a sex trafficking victim. Whereas these guys are just Putin stooges in a way. Being able to understand how something has come about doesn't mean that you're okay with the fact that it came about. Absolutely. Put it that way. What do you think, everybody? Do you think these guys should be allowed back home? Do you think they should be jailed or not? I think we just had a comment from Mike, which got taken down before we were able to read it out and have it back in. Some people, especially ex-army people, will search out any opportunity to hold a gun. These guys aren't ex-army because the army would never have had them fundamentally. But there is certainly a case that some ex-military have gone, I think, to join and fight in Ukraine. And that's legal. That's allowed. At the moment. Anyway, who knows what will happen next week. But that's acceptable. This fighting for the bad guys is not. Now, we've had all this going on for a while now, and at some point the war in Ukraine will have a decisive end, one way or the other. It doesn't look like it's going to come anytime soon. And when that happens, these guys, they may not have survived, because it's an absolute mincing machine out there, like I said, and they're not being treated terribly well by their generals. Generals very rarely do treat their troops well. But, you know, we'll have to sort of wait and see how some of this actually falls out and whether the British authorities treat them the same way as they did Shamima Begum if they try to return. We'll have to wait and see for that one, won't we? All right. Thank you for that, Darren, and explaining some of that to us. Now, we have managed to find some good news in the world, and it's about an ex-army person, actually. So here it is. Now, this guy has not picked up a gun again. You might not think there's nothing more bonkers than trying to climb Mount Kilimanjaro with a fridge on your back. But HGV driver and former squaddie Michael Copeland, former ex-Grenadier Guards, would agree with you. And that's why he's done exactly that, to raise awareness of mental health. Now, Darren, I think we're all aware, having seen these pictures, that he's not quite sane, probably. And we're certainly more aware of his mental health. But is this proof, do you think, that, you know, commitment to a cause for all the right reasons often produces far better results and public approval than choosing all the wrong reasons.
Well, I was thinking maybe you and I were the ones who were not quite sane for not thinking of doing it ourselves.
I think about it, I go, no. It's as simple as that. Why would I do this? Why would anyone? Why? Why? I mean, why would anyone strap a fish to their back? Never mind, try and climb a mountain with it. You know, he says in there that, you know, at one point that he was, you know, he's got altitude sickness. He's running out of breath. He hasn't got enough oxygen in his body. Most people can't get up Kilimanjaro flat. They're doing it on their own. Never mind with a bit of a 30K fridge on their back. I hope he had some beer in it.
Well, I know you know this, but 19,340 feet, Kilimanjaro, Africa's highest mountain. And my favorite quote in the story is where Michael Copeland, isn't it? He says, most people struggle up there without a fridge. You don't say. And look, I think you're right about the fact that, you know, the commitment to a cause is something to be applauded when people are so committed that they will use unorthodox means to be able to achieve their objectives. We see it all the time on a very a much lower level, quite literally, in the London Marathon, where people run for 3-4 hours dressed in a dinosaur suit, if you like, or like dressed as Thomas the Tank Engine or something. This is quite some commitment to the cause. There's another terrific quote in Martin Fricker's piece, which is probably my favorite piece of the day, where Michael says, I've been bodybuilding for 10 years. I'm only 5'7", so I'm built for carrying fridges. So what you need to do today, wherever you are in the world watching this, you need to ask yourself, are you built for carrying fridges?
And if not, which household appliance are you built to carry? Me, I would suggest mug, maybe biscuit barrel. Right? Biscuit barrel under an arm. I'm built to carry a biscuit barrel. Don't carry a laptop. What else might you be built to carry if it's not a fridge? I know I'm not built to carry a fridge. Definitely not. I'm barely built to carry a beanbag. So we'll have to just see. But well done, Michael. You managed to raise awareness of mental health anyway. I don't know if there's any fundraising that is attached to it, but anyway, we might be able to find something and attach to the comments if there is. Thank you, Darren, for taking us through all that. Thank you, everyone, for taking part. If you're listening on podcast, you can't see my terrible fringe, please leave us a review so everyone else can find us. And we'll see you again. We won't see you on Monday because it's Easter Monday. We've got a day off. We'll see you this time next week, next Wednesday, for another edition of the News Agenda. Prime Minister's questions will be on these channels at 12 o'clock noon. And I dare say Keir Starmer will be asking if there's anybody left in government. And so we will see you on Monday. Until then, everybody, stay safe, take care, and tatty bye. Toodaloo.